And I remember in Mrs. Cowger's social studies class, I would get the hiccups. I was so nervous. I'd get the hiccups. It's loud. I'm feeling weird. And she'd call me up and I thought I was going to get in trouble. And she'd give me this great big piece of Hubba Bubba bubble gum. Because chewing gum will get your breath regulating a little bit more. And magically, it can get rid of hiccups. Doesn't always work, I found, but it worked on fifth grade me back at Nisswa Elementary. We'd love to hear your story. You can text 218-326-1234. Weather around the region. Don't forget, dry conditions may lead to near critical fire weather. Check burning restrictions and fire danger before burning. Sunny skies today, highs 64 to 72, southeast winds 5 to 10, gusting up to 15. Clear overnight with lows 34 to 53 and areas of frost on the Iron Range possible. Mostly sunny tomorrow, chance of sprinkles, highs in the mid to upper 70s to low 80s. The Up North Report is next on 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, or on your smart speaker. We are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Thanks for being a member. Join us at KAXE.org.
For KAXE News, I'm Chelsea Perkins with the Up North Report. Staples police have made an arrest after a threat of violence directed at the Staples-Motley School District's outdoor activities area. In news releases, the district and the police department say the threat occurred shortly after school was let out on Tuesday. A caller made the threat directly to the Todd County 911 Dispatch Center. The district says that school employees immediately brought all students and staff into the school building and went into lockdown protocol. Students were then safely reunited with their parents and guardians. Classes resumed as normal on Wednesday. Carrie Heintzman has been sworn in as the newest Minnesota State Senator after her electoral victory last week. The Nisswa Republican was issued the oath of office by Associate Justice Paul Thiessen of the Minnesota Supreme Court at the start of Tuesday's floor session.
Do you solemnly swear to support the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the State of Minnesota, and to discharge faithfully your duties as a senator to the best of your judgment and ability, so help you God?
I do.
All right, congratulations.
Thank you.
Welcome. That's it. You can clap if you want.
After Heintzman moved from senator-elect to senator, it restored representation for Senate District 6 for the first time since Justin Eichhorn's resignation in March. The legislative body went on with its business of debating bills, and Heintzman cast her first votes. One of the bills updated requirements for homeowners associations, including capping fines, requiring disclosure of conflicts of interest for board members, and setting up new rules to settle HOA disputes. The Minnesota Reformer reports that some senators on both sides of the aisle expressed concerns over the burden of the new regulations on HOA boards, which are usually staffed by volunteers. Heintzman supported an amendment that would have allowed board members to vote on matters in which they had a material financial interest, provided that they had disclosed that interest to the board. That amendment failed 32-34, largely on party lines. She ultimately joined a bipartisan group of 43 others in passing the bill. The Senate also passed a bill to change a paid sick leave law passed 2 years ago, with six self-described Blue Dog Democrats voting with Republicans. It would repeal the benefit for tens of thousands of workers at small farms and micro businesses. Hermantown DFLer Grant Hochschild was among the Dems who voted for the change, marking a departure from his vote in 2023 to pass a sweeping pro-labor agenda with the DFL majority. The law, as it stands, entitled workers to 1 hour of paid sick leave for every 30 hours they work, up to 6 days for full-time employees. The bill carves out farms with five or fewer employees and other businesses with three or fewer employees.
These are reasonable changes, and it's still, I want to reiterate, Minnesota will have the most generous earned sick and safe time policy and paid family leave policy in the country, and I'm proud of that.
Both of these bills now head to the House to be considered. The Lakes Area Music Festival is among the grant recipients that received an email from the federal government on Friday saying that their National Endowment of the Arts funds were canceled. The Brainerd organization brings top classical musicians to the area for performances. Megan Buffington has more.
Executive and Artistic Director Scott Likens remembers when Lakes Area Music Festival got its first NEA grant after several rejections.
That really made us feel like we had the national stamp of approval on our programs.
In January, the organization was awarded its largest NEA grant to date to support an opera production. Likens' first thought after receiving the cancellation notice was, how will we replace that $20,000?
Because at this point, we have contracts already signed by our artists, and we're not going to back out of any of those.
This summer will be Lakes Area Music Festival's 17th season, and they've already announced the shows. The team for Engelbert Humperdinck's Hansel and Gretel has already had several meetings. Likens says they're going on with their season, but they have a little extra work to raise funds through their donors.
But this is a time where everyone is also dealing with increased costs of everyday items and a really uncertain stock market that's affecting financial planning. So that'll be an extra challenge.
He says arts are for everyone, a bipartisan issue that connects communities, and that makes them easy to support. Megan Buffington, KAXE News.
That's it for the Up North Report from the KAXE News Desk. I'm Chelsea Perkins, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is sponsored by Woodland Bank, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River, dedicated to serving the financial needs of the community and their customers. More info at woodland.bank.
Good morning. It's 7:06. We've got more news coming up next from Morning Edition. We're going to be learning about Warren Buffett, the 94-year-old billionaire investor known as the Oracle of Omaha. He is retiring at 94. Stay tuned for that story. I'm Heidi Holton with Jennifer Barr. Good morning.
Good morning.
We've been hearing from folks like Mary in Cass Lake. She's going to be spending time with her 85-year-old mom and her daughter this weekend, which sounds great.
Nice.
We've also got coming up, so this is our last week for our Report for Minnesota student reporters at the Capitol. So not only will they report on what they've been learning at the Capitol, but they're going to talk about what they learned working with Chelsea Perkins. And they're getting a variety of experience, and radio is one of the things that they're learning how to do. And we have their articles. They're available at kexc.org. And we're very excited. We'll continue our partnership with the University of Minnesota Hubbard School of Journalism and this Report for Minnesota. We have an intern journalist coming this summer, spend a few months with us, and we can't wait. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Looking forward to it. Sunny today, highs 64 to 72, winds from the southeast 5 to 10, gusting higher, clear skies overnight, lows anywhere from 34 to 53, areas of frost on the Iron Range, and mostly sunny tomorrow, but a chance of sprinkles, highs in the mid to upper 70s to low 80s.
We receive support from Grand Rapids State Bank. They're committed to serving the Grand Rapids area for over 110 years. More at grsb.bank, member FDIC, and equal housing lender.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faudel. The Oracle of Omaha is ready for retirement. At age 94, the billionaire investor Warren Buffett is stepping down as CEO of Berkshire Hathaway. His company is one of the world's largest and owns businesses ranging from insurance and railroads to Dairy Queen and Duracell. But Buffett also has fans far beyond Wall Street. NPR financial correspondent Maria Aspen reports from Omaha.
They came from all over.
From London.
Boston. South of Omaha, about 30 miles.
We're from a little town of 26,000 people, Fort Dodge.
Thousands of investors in Berkshire Hathaway flocked to downtown Omaha last weekend for a yearly event known as Woodstock for Capitalists. They came to shop at a gigantic pop-up mall full of Berkshire-owned brands like See's Candies, Fruit of the Loom underwear, and Geico-branded pickleball sets.
Pickleball. Christmas.
Are you going to buy that?
Yes, I am.
They came to run in a Berkshire-sponsored 5K race.
You're not just running. You're rebalancing your life portfolio.
And most of all, they came to pay tribute to Warren Buffett.
This is my 60th annual meeting,
And it's the biggest, and I think it'll be the best yet.
Buffett is one of the giants of American capitalism. He's made common sense investing accessible to regular people, and he's made a ton of money for his shareholders and himself. Two of his faithful are Lorenzo Alon and Peter Shea.
Listen, I'm almost 80 years old, and Warren Buffett is going to retire soon. I want to see him.
Yes, I've always wanted to come, so we thought this we got to come soon, sooner than later.
Buffett is also famous for being, well, normal, at least for a billionaire. He's built a cult of personality as a humble, folksy Midwesterner who eats at McDonald's and has lived in the same house since 1958. Rosalind Trum lives in Omaha. She's been coming to Berkshire's annual meeting for decades.
It's spiritual and morally uplifting. I think it's remarkable to hear Warren talk about what business and society and values should be.
That's all stuff that Buffett loves to talk about. He's one of the wealthiest men in the world. But he markets himself as a frugal, down-to-earth senior citizen. And in many ways, he is. He's given away a lot of his money, and he's encouraged other billionaires to do the same.
He is a capitalist, but he's also a responsible citizen and a decent human being.
Kathy Seifert is an analyst who covers Berkshire for CFRA Research.
When the general public bashes billionaires, I don't think they're bashing Buffett.
That's a real accomplishment right now, at a time that billionaires like Elon Musk are wielding unprecedented political power in the United States and becoming widely unpopular for it. Buffett usually avoids talking politics, but last weekend he did weigh in on President Trump's sweeping new tariffs in his usual folksy style.
In the United States, I mean, we should be looking to trade with the rest of the world, and we should do what we do best, and they should do what they do best. Trade should not be a weapon.
So Buffett has long stood for stability and the wealth that comes from it. But now he's shaking things up. On Saturday, Buffett surprised everyone by handing the reins to his deputy, Greg Abel.
The time has arrived where Greg should become the chief executive officer of the company at year end.
A 94-year-old announcing his retirement shouldn't be that shocking. Buffett will remain chair of Berkshire, and he publicly designated Abel as his successor years ago. But Abel just doesn't have the same Main Street celebrity Buffett does. So at some point, Berkshire Hathaway and its investors will have to figure out life without its beloved billionaire. Still, some shareholders are keeping the faith. Hours before Buffett announced his retirement, I asked Lorenzo Alon how he thinks about Berkshire after Buffett.
I feel confident. I told my kids, do not sell it. You know, you sell your house, your jewelry, don't sell Berkshire.
That's the kind of devotion that money alone can't buy. Maria Aspen, NPR News, Omaha.
Thanks to Nebraska Public Media's Arthur Jones for his additional reporting on that story.
Three former Memphis police officers have been acquitted. A jury found them not guilty of second-degree murder in the 2023 beating death of Tyree Nichols. Kate Reardon from member station WKNO reports on the reactions in Memphis.
Tadarius Bean, Demetrius Haley, and Justin Smith hugged one another and their lawyers after they were found not guilty in the state trial. Shelby County District Attorney Steve Mulroy said he respects the jury's decision, but couldn't believe there weren't any convictions, even for lesser charges, including official misconduct.
Yes, I was surprised. Do I have an explanation for it? No.
The state's case grew out of graphic police videos that captured Nichols' violent arrest after a traffic stop. He died in the hospital 3 days after five officers who were all initially charged in the case were shown restraining, kicking, punching, and striking him with a baton. Like Nichols, they are all also black. Defense attorneys said Nichols resisted arrest, ran from officers after they pulled him over, and that individually, the defendants complied with their police training. The defense also sought to shift blame to another one of the officers on the scene, Emmett Martin, who repeatedly kicked and punched Nichols in the head. Martin had already agreed to plead guilty to state charges.
We've, as a world community, saw the same video footage. And to have this jury reach this conclusion is inconceivable.
That's Pastor J. Lawrence Turner, a Memphis community leader. He encouraged those struggling with the verdict to focus on civic engagement with police reform.
We can't come to this moment and give up. It's in these times, these critical times, that we've got to be a witness for what's morally right.
Nichols' mother testified at the trial about how her son was on his way home for dinner when officers stopped him. Her attorney called the verdict a, quote, devastating miscarriage of justice. In a separate federal trial last fall, a jury found all three men who were just acquitted guilty of witness tampering. Two of their former colleagues also pleaded guilty to federal charges. All are expected to be sentenced later this year. For NPR News, I'm Katie Reardon.
This is NPR News.
Morning edition from National Public Radio here on People Powered KAXE at 7:15. Up next, learning about what's going on at the Capitol from our student reporters in the program Report for Minnesota. Chelsea Perkins will have the story. She'll be back with us before 8 o'clock talking about what stories the newsroom's been working on this week.
Coming up at 9:30 this morning, Heidi, you are part of a panel with columnist Aaron Brown on growth in Grand Rapids. It's at Rapids Brewing, 9:30 this morning, hosted by the Minnesota Star Tribune, including Sholem Blake from the Grand Rapids Economic Development Authority, Derek Fox from Minnesota North College, and Andy Nitzel, co-founder of MN Technology.
That's right. We're going to be focusing on growth in small towns, specifically in the Grand Rapids area. If you have growth in your region and want to tell us about it, what's positive going on, or you know, what you think could change, you can text me this morning, 218-326-1234. That's Jennifer Barr sitting in for our Kari Hedlund, who's off on a music conference, learning about lots of great music. She's out in Philly this week.
Yeah, WXPN, which hosts always is the World Cafe station. And so she's getting to see lots of great artists, connect with other people that do jobs like hers.
Yeah. Yeah, I got a text from her earlier this week. So she met someone in the band, The Head and the Heart.
Ooh.
And something came up, and I think she was talking about what's new here or something like that. And she said, she talked about Ham Radio, Cooking with Amy Thielen, this new show that will premiere on May 23rd. Turns out it was Amy's cousin who's in the band, The Head and the Heart.
Really?
Yes. Isn't that crazy? So she knew about the show.
Yeah.
And then I was working with Amy yesterday. We're working really hard on producing this show. It's going to be live, but we've got lots of great interviews as well. And it's an interesting story. If she didn't know she was her cousin, and they met through, and I don't, I saw your eyes going, I don't know how that happens. So you, yeah. Although I have lots of cousins I don't exactly know. So,
sure.
But anyway, she ended up going to see her. Like they had kind of interacted on social media, and Amy didn't know what to think. And then she realized, oh, she really is my cousin. And I got to see her, and based on that. So it was real, very funny. So she'll be listening in from afar as her cousin puts on this great show for us. Amy is a James Beard Award-winning cookbook author and a chef and writer. We're going to be talking about cooking and what it means to us and the stories. It's coming up on May 23rd, our first week. We'll have a theme every week is how it'll go. And then you'll also get a recipe at the end of each show that we ask you to participate with us and make that recipe. And then the next week, tell us how it went.
All right.
Let us know if it worked. We'll give you some advice on that. But our first topic is risky business. So whatever risk might mean to you in cooking, like mm-hmm. if you've never made, I've never made pasta, for instance, that would be a risk for me to try.
Correct.
But we're hearing about Amy's epic journey of making her own lutefisk. And this doesn't mean just cooking it.
It's yes. like actually processing the fish yes. with lye.
Yes. And the 85-year-old from Wisconsin who helped her do it will be talking to Wally about it as well. But it should be a lot of fun. We've got a lot of great different topics, and we'll be talking to people from northern Minnesota. You might be hearing from people in grocery stores. You might be hearing from chefs across the country about things that they care about, like endangered recipes, you know, things that might not be made anymore because of our fast-paced world. There's just a whole world to explore through cooking. So we're very excited about it. It's at a new time. It's 6 p.m. on Fridays. And we'll run it for 6 weeks, and we're really excited about it. And we hope that you'll be a part. If you've got a risky recipe to tell us about that you tried, whether it worked or didn't work, you can text us now at 218-326-1234.
Yeah, so 6 p.m. live on Fridays, and then it will also re-air Saturdays at 1 o'clock.
Yep, and Sundays at 10. Okay. So you'll get a lot of chance to be involved in that, and we want you to tell us, you know, if you have questions about cooking or how you might want to, if you want to record something to be a part of it or call in. It should be a lot of fun.
All right.
Up next, we are going to be hearing from our students from the Report for Minnesota project that we are a part of at the University of Minnesota School of Journalism, Hubbard School of Journalism.
Minnesota's legislative session and the school year are both coming to a close soon, and that means we're saying goodbye to the Report from Minnesota student journalists who've helped us cover the Capitol this year. I'm Chelsea Perkins, and I got a chance to chat with the University of Minnesota interns from the Hubbard School of Journalism and Mass Communication one last time before their internships came to an end. Sam Cito, Yvette Higgins, and Elias Thomas join me to talk about their final three stories covering the state legislature. All right, Sam, so it's the last week of coverage at the state capitol for you. What did you choose for your final story?
Yes, it's been surreal. I chose to look at the House and Senate just passed their individual agriculture budgets, their budget plans, and I looked at and took a breakdown into their bird flu prevention included in those budgets.
And bird flu, of course, has been a huge topic of concern. It's part of the reason that egg prices surged so much in the past several months. So what did you learn when you looked through those plans?
I found, first of all, that it's not super easy to give a direct number onto how much each of these budget plans are devoting toward bird flu. So I focused specifically on the amounts that included a specific provision about the fact that that money was supposed to go specifically to bird flu research prevention. But there's a lot to be said in terms of money that is meant to, in part, help the bird flu epidemic that's wrapped into other funding, like emergency funding. I definitely learned that it's something that's seen as important by the whole legislature right now to look into kind of more inventive ways of dealing with this epidemic. And I think that's something that's particularly pertinent in the wake of the COVID pandemic. Both of the budgets include varying amounts, but funding meant to go to bird flu prevention methods that are beyond the typical. So you have like these turkey lasers that are meant to prevent wild birds from coming into poultry farms or cow farms or whatever it is and spread the disease. So there was a lot of funding that was dedicated specifically to more experimental forms of preventing the outbreaks.
Did you just say turkey lasers? Did I hear you right?
Yep, turkey lasers, which is not their scientific name at all, but that is what Senator Eric Putnam very affectionately referred to them as. He was very impressed by the turkey lasers. We spoke a great deal about them.
What did you learn that you didn't know before about this topic as you were exploring the story?
I learned that, and I'm not someone who's from Minnesota, so this might have been a given to many people, that Minnesota is the largest domestic exporter of turkeys. So when you think about something like bird flu, that yes, now it's affecting cows and some humans as well, but primarily has decimated poultry farms, that's a really, really difficult thing for Minnesota's agriculture. So I learned that Minnesota is in this unique position where we are being very drastically affected by bird flu, maybe to a greater extent than some other states who do not have as large of an agriculture industry as part of their economy.
Moving on here, Yvette, let's hear about the story that you covered this week.
My story focused on the Student Parent Support Initiative, which is an initiative that helps students who are parents just give them financial support either through scholarships or setting up childcare. It's kind of different campus to campus, but basically the government gives money to programs that help student parents succeed in as parents and as students. The idea with that this week was that The House and Senate both had their budget bills for higher education this week, but they had different amounts of money that were going to the Student Parent Support Initiative. So the Senate wanted to continue that initiative by giving it $6 million in the next 2 years, but the House was only going to give it $2 million and then in the next 2 years, and then after those 2 years, it was going to cut the program completely.
What did you hear from legislators on each side of this coin as to their reasons for either supporting or wanting to cut the program?
Budgets are really tight this year. The Senate and the House had different budgets. So the Senate had a $100 million budget of additional funding, but the House was trying to not spend any additional funding because there is like a $239 million budget deficit in the state grant program, which is the program that helps low and middle income students pay for their higher education. So I think the idea in the House was that they're going to cut this program that's pretty new just to save money. But in the Senate, and the people who were in support of the bill were saying that this wouldn't actually save money in the long run, because these parents that are going to school, if they get good degrees and become like successful citizens, then they'll actually spend more in taxes over their lives and contribute to the workforce, and they'll actually give the state more money than the state is saving by not funding this program.
Where did we end up landing on this?
The story was due Wednesday, so at that time, only the House had voted, but I checked this morning and the Senate has also voted. So I think both bills passed, and then they're going to go to a conference committee of House and Senate members, and they're going to kind of decide and compromise. So I talked to Senator Kupek, and he said that he really didn't know how it was going to go because they're in uncharted waters here with the tied House. So it's kind of unclear what's going to happen with this program.
Did you hear from any people who have been able to attend school because of this programming?
Mm-hmm. I talked to a woman named Karina Vieda. She is a 29-year-old University of Minnesota student, and she has a 4-year-old daughter. And she just had so many great things to say about this program. She said that they helped her with mental health struggles, because there's a lot of stress involved in being a student and a parent, because usually you also have to work a full-time job to support your family. So she said that the program was vital in her life to help her succeed. And she's graduating this semester, but she is doing like a traditional 4-year path. And then the year after next, she plans to go to grad school to become a lawyer. So the program really helped her achieve her goals, she said, both as a student and as a parent.
Moving on to Elias, what was the story that you worked on this week?
Yeah, so I actually touched on this a couple of weeks ago when I reported on the House Transportation Bill, which did just pass through the House last week. And the part that I focused on was the increase to the electric vehicle surcharge, which is going from $75 to $200 a year. And so that's $200 on top of all other registration fees they have to pay to help make up for basically the money that they're not paying in taxes towards the state in gas tax. The really important thing that ended up being the bulk of my story was there was an amendment to only make this increase from $75 to $100, not the full $200. But the amendment, after a couple witty remarks back and forth, it did not pass. It tied. It was ended up being a partisan thing.
Yet another example of the joys of having a completely tied House, I suppose, right?
Yeah, definitely. What I found interesting was the representative that proposed the amendment, Representative Larry Craft. He said at the beginning, like when he introduced the amendment, he was like, I hope this is a friendly amendment. Like it shouldn't ruffle too many, you know, it makes sense, whatever. And sure enough, a tie still occurred. So.
All right. Anything else you think was worth mentioning on your story from this week?
I found it interesting. Representative Kosnick made a little joke towards Kraft during the floor hearing about he was glad to see the Democrats changing their views on taxes and wanting to lower taxes, which he said this, you know, in a jokey way, and that he hoped that it went through for everyone else, which I guess was also interesting because this is one that the Republicans are raising the tax on. But just a few days earlier, Speaker of the House, Lisa DeMuth, said you know, no new tax increases. That's what I can guarantee. Regardless of your opinions on either side, it's interesting to see kind of that banter back and forth. And I think that that's unfortunately going to be something that happens a lot over the next couple of weeks as they're finalizing all these bills and conversations. So
I'm Chelsea Perkins, and you're listening to my conversation with Report from Minnesota student journalists Sam Cito, Yvette Higgins, and Elias Thomas. I also wanted to hear what these young reporters were feeling after completing the semester at the Capitol, and what it was like for them to be at the center of state government action at this point in their burgeoning careers.
I think it was really exciting and very different than I originally anticipated. I feel like in our first Zoom, we talked about how we all kind of thought of politics reporting in this one kind of box, but I realized through this experience that there's a lot more to it. It's not just talking to politicians, which is also interesting and important, but some of my best stories and some of the like most exciting experiences when I got to talk to like concerned citizens. I'm not sure if you remember that when I talked to Wendy Manuel, the mother whose daughter had died of alcohol poisoning, and she was supporting that bill to not allow alcohol delivery. So it was just exciting to get my feet in to politics reporting and to like realize how much you can add that human interest aspect to it. And I think that was the most helpful part. And I also think that politics reporting is a really important skill for any journalist to have, because you can always include a political angle. And even in my stories, like for class that don't necessarily have to have politics reporting, I've started reaching out to legislators to get their opinions on these topics. So
yeah, I think similarly, I found this to be a really cool, unique opportunity that I enjoy not only as a journalist, but also just as a like a citizen, to see kind of the part of politics that you don't always see, like the small stuff, the little bills that they're working out. I think we see so much of that left first right in the news. And so seeing really what goes on in state politics is eye-opening and interesting and valuable as a journalist. I caught myself the other day writing a story for another class, and it was a little more of a narrative style, but I caught myself writing in this very like uniform political tone. And it's just been interesting for me to see the response from readers and citizens and how like these stories are helping them out and informing them on things that probably wouldn't have known about otherwise. So I really enjoyed that aspect of it too.
You guys have had really great summaries thus far. I would also say that I have only solidified my want to be a journalist and my belief in the importance of good journalism through this internship. It's crazy to think that, especially coming in the first few weeks, like you have all of this legislation and you're the person to choose what you want to narrow in on. Even within a larger bill, there's smaller pieces to hone in on, and the kind of weight that you take on as a journalist and deciding, okay, what is the most important news? That's not something that I've ever taken particularly lightly, but this definitely kind of solidified that feeling that, okay, as this consolidator of information, which is really what a journalist is, we're news gatherers, you're really deciding what is the most important for people to know that are reading your paper or reading wherever you distribute your news. And that's definitely something not to take lightly. I think the human side of politics is a big thing as well. And the, like Yvette said, not just speaking to legislators, although they are also human, which is something that is also weird to kind of get a more direct experience with as you're starting out, but speaking to people who would be or have been directly affected by legislation is really interesting. It's definitely also added to my feeling that politics is important in everything, no matter what the topic is, as Yvette said.
So as part of this program, your stories ran in several newspapers across greater Minnesota, ran on our website. Some of your stories appeared in our newscast as well. And what kind of feedback have you gotten? And what was it like to just have your name out there and be published in this way? It's a pretty good experience for a young journalist to be this broadly published across so many different publications.
I would say, weirdly enough, the feedback has been very indirect. It's sometimes it's coming for you, letting us know what people are thinking, or our editor just told us how many pats on the back we're getting for our work. But being able to look up my name with Report from Minnesota and see my work come up is something that's really cool. And it shows up on different reporting websites where there's comment sections and things like that. And so I kind of look through some of those. It's just cool that my work is what people are learning from, and feels good, I guess. I don't know. It it's cool to have my work actually do something.
I'd echo Elias on that. I have also had a couple of people who I've written about, who I've interviewed for stories, post those stories from various outlets on their LinkedIns or their personal Instagrams or Facebooks, or tweeted them out or X'd them out. I don't know what the proper terminology is there, but posted them on some sort of social media. And it's crazy to be like, okay, like, I really enjoy having conversations with people about things that they're passionate about and being able to put that into writing. And the idea that I'm getting appreciated by that, or that someone who I've spoken with has been happy enough with my representation of them and their opinions that they would post that on their own social media, has been very rewarding.
It never gets old, even though we've been doing this for 12 weeks and it should feel maybe normal right now to see our name published in papers. I would say it never gets old and it never stops being exciting to see your name on a real deal website. Like every week I go in and I refresh the page and check for my story over and over again and see which other papers have picked it up. I think we all feel really accomplished. And in terms of feedback, yeah, we've got nothing but positive feedback from editors. So I'm really glad that we were able to fill in some of those news gaps for rural Minnesota.
That was Yvette Higgins, Elias Thomas, and Sam Cito of Report from Minnesota. We wish them the best of luck as they head into their futures. Thanks to the University of Minnesota Hubbard School of Journalism and Mass Communication for allowing KAXE to be a part of this year's pilot program. For KAXE News, I'm Chelsea Perkins.
This is the Thursday morning show. It's People Powered, KAXE. Again, we're looking forward to another student reporter coming this summer as an intern for Report for Minnesota. I'm Heidi Holton.
I'm Jennifer Barr.
Thanks for tuning in. We've got best wishes coming up next.
We receive support from Coldwell Banker Northwoods Realty, helping guide your real estate journey in northern Minnesota since 1947. From buying or selling to land or lakeshore, Coldwell Banker Northwoods Realty. More at coldwellbankernorthwoods.com.
Don't forget, dry conditions may lead to near critical fire weather today. Check burning restrictions and fire danger before burning. Sunny with highs 64 to 72. Southeast winds 5 to 10. Gusting up to 15. Clear overnight, lows 34 to 53 degrees. Could see some areas of frost, like in the Virginia area, overnight. And then on Friday, could be sprinkles in the morning, then highs in the mid to upper 70s. We heard from our friend Finn Billy from the Smoky Hills, reminding people about the fire danger out there and to douse your campfires at least 3 times is what he's saying. Like, there's not too much water that you could put on that campfire. So keep that in mind over your opening fishing and Mother's Day weekend.
Time for best wishes. We're going to do our best to wish our friends and neighbors happy birthday, happy anniversary. Today is May 8th. Happy 54th anniversary to Jim and Paula Harding from Brainerd. Dan and Kathy Dart celebrating 53 years of marriage in Cromwell.
And happy birthday, Tim McDonald, 69 today from Grand Rapids. And Sam O'Brien from Cook. Happy 45th to you. We're going to listen to Jeremy Albino.
Coming to Grand Rapids River Fest Saturday, September 6th. You can find all the information and tickets at grandrapidsriverfest.com.
Jennifer, you're telling me about Jeremy Albino and his Instagram presence?
Yeah, I've been following on an Instagram just to get so excited for Grand Rapids Riverfest. He's been touring in Europe right now, and so he's playing these like kind of just small clubs, and there's been, you know, just videos of him playing live. It's going to be so much fun at Grand Rapids Riverfest. Can't wait. Saturday, September 6th, he will be joined by Alan Sparhawk's going to kick things off, then Jeremy, and then Margo Price and Courtney Barnett. And tickets are on sale now. It's the early bird sale currently. Also, KAXE members are now getting a $10 discount. Find tickets and all the information at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com.
That's right. And if you have any, we've been helping some folks out. You need a code to get that discount if you're a KAXE member. So text us or just let us know. We'll help you through that process.
Yeah, it should have been emailed to you, but we don't always have everybody's email. And so if we didn't have your email or might have gone to your, you know, spam, just let us know. You can contact Heather at KAXE.org.
Coming up, we'll have our daily dose of phenology, and then we'll check in with Chelsea Perkins about the news from KEXE's newsroom this week.
Support comes from Hot Tubs of Northern Minnesota on Middle School Avenue in Bemidji, offering hot tubs, pool tables, and saunas. Learn more online at hotspringhottubmn.com.
It's time for John Latimer and our daily dose of phenology.
On today's date, May 8th, in 1991, the Juneberries are blooming. This is the average first date for Juneberries to bloom, and in 91, they landed right smack dab on average. I expect that Juneberries will be among the first of the big white flowering shrubs to bloom in northern Minnesota. They should be easy to spot. Oftentimes, they look like clouds caught in a forest of trees. There'll be great gobs of white flowers as these things break out. And oddly enough, Juneberries are synchronous flowering plants. That is, when they open their flowers, they're all open at once. And this is an advantage because then the insects come in and they can pollinate all of these flowers at once, moving from one bush to the next. But they are asynchronous when it comes to fruiting, and they fruit at staggered rates, which allows the plants to have a better chance of getting some of those seeds into the soil and to have new Juneberries growing.
It's your daily dose of phenology. If you missed our nature programming this week, you can check out our website at kaxe.org and find some of our stories from this week, from last week. One of them is about waterfowl and how the students are kind of on a mission to solve why some waterfowl have been murdered.
Yeah.
So if you like murder podcasts, this might be the thing for you.
That is this week's, student talkback story as the lead photo.
Yeah.
And it's a little grim, but it's nature.
There you go. Drama of nature. Check it out at kaxe.org or sign up for that Season Watch newsletter, and you'll get links every single week to topics you didn't even realize that you wanted to know something about, like breaking bud and all the things that you hear John Latimer talk about. You can subscribe very easily. Just put your email address in at kaxe.org. Look on the right-hand side of the page. Let's see, I should look at what the current temperatures are. When I was driving in this morning, it was like 38 degrees out there. And right now we are seeing temperatures. Let's update this because I think it's warmer than that. Okay,
yeah.
40 degrees right now in Grand Rapids, 37 in Hibbing, sunny skies, 43 in Bemidji, Park Rapids at 42. And we are seeing that Brainerd is at 40 degrees this morning. And Aiken at 38. With sunny skies, it's going to be a beautiful day, 64 to 72 around our region.
We receive support from Paul Bunyan Communications, powered by the GigaZone, a broadband cooperative featuring all fiber optic, GigaZone internet speeds up to 10 gig, and local customer service. Learn more at paulbunyan.net.
Time to talk news from the KEXC newsroom. Our news director, Chelsea Perkins, joins us from Brainerd. Chelsea, thanks for being here today.
Good morning.
Morning.
Well, let's talk about, you had a big story last week that you worked on. Tell us kind of the story of your story. Like, why were you interested and what did you find?
So the Bridge on 7th is a warming shelter in Brainerd. Warming shelter as in a place where people can sleep overnight in the wintertime, in the cold months. I've been covering the story of homelessness in the Brainerd Lakes area for my entire career as a journalist, starting back when I was at the Brainerd Dispatch and the Echo Journal. And to see this shelter come here was a big step in the right direction for addressing that issue. For a long time, there was really nothing available for folks, or there was a program called New Pathways, which is only available to families with children. So, of course, that left out a huge portion of the population that may be in need. Basically, between Bemidji and St. Cloud, there was no shelter available at all. So there was a point in time when folks, if they needed shelter, they might get a hotel room for a night or two that was sponsored by Salvation Army. And then they would give them a bus ticket to St. Cloud and say, hopefully you can get in the shelter there. So for the last 4 years, the Bridge on 7th shelter has been in place. And last summer, the Brainerd City Council and the Baxter City Councils both voted to make camping on public property against the law in the city. It was an ordinance that was put in place that made it illegal, had it a fine associated with it, and a criminal penalty. So the folks who run Bridge on 7th, Bridges of Hope, the nonprofit, they're like, great, let's plan on being open all year round now, being available for people in the summertime. Now, where this most recent wrinkle comes into play is that the Brainerd City Council denied their interim use permit, the permit they need to operate the shelter where it's located, that would have permitted them to stay open for the summer months. So right now, as of May 1st, anyone who is homeless in the Brainerd and Baxter areas has literally nowhere to sleep legally unless they're able to find someone to stay with, a couch to sleep on, and you know, that, of course, places their friends and family in potentially sticky situations as well, of breaking leases. And so it's a difficult situation all around for the people who are stuck outside, the people who are trying to make a difference, and the council members who feel like, you know, they're tasked with making a difficult decision of how to proceed.
So, Chelsea, you know, tell us, like, who you met. I think people, we sometimes don't think about who might be homeless out there, and there's a kind of a stereotype about it.
Yeah, so I went there, the Bridge on 7th. It's actually just down the street from where I'm living, and I met this man named William. He's 58 years old, and he's just about to start his new job at Costco in Baxter. He'll be demonstrating. You know how you go there on the weekends, or you know, you get to taste all the food. He'll be doing that. And he was really excited. He's been doing customer service type work for most of his life and been a server. And but what he wasn't excited about was that he didn't know where he'd be sleeping. And he also was worried about getting there. And if he were not able to sleep in Brainerd or Baxter, like, how is he going to get to his job? And I also met a man named Jeffrey. He planned on basically the one, you know, worldly possession he seemed to still have was an old pontoon, and that was on family's property, and he was planning on fixing it up and trying to make it seaworthy for the summer so that he could live on a lake and try to, you know, avoid the weather. And he's like, I know that lake really well. I know where to go if it's storming. And but just think about that, you know, think about having no opportunity to go inside. I also met several other guys, and one who was working there, and he is an employee of the shelter. But most recently, he was a guest of the shelter. He and his wife now are living in another organization's housing that has recently been put into place in Brainerd called My Neighbor to Love Coalition. And he's able to basically be in stable housing there and get reduced rent, decent rent, by helping out, doing service projects around the area and at the actual location. He helped build the place. And so now he's living in stable housing. That's one thing the Bridges of Hope really wanted to emphasize, was that there was 170 people who stayed at the shelter in the past year. 50 of those people, which is a pretty decent percentage, have already been placed in more permanent housing as a result of getting connected with services. You know, most people, this is a short-term solution for them. This is just the bare necessities, right? A place to sleep.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about numbers, but yeah, 170 in the past year?
Correct. Yeah, that was over the winter months. So they opened in last September, they close in May. And right now, I mean, that building is just sitting there empty. And so for a lot of people who support the shelter and Bridges of Hope and the faith communities around here, they're really pushing hard on the council to change its mind. I watched the meeting again on Monday night. This is the second meeting now since they made that decision. And 45 minutes of people just, you know, probably I didn't count, but a dozen people I would guess that came up to talk about how, just please change your minds. There's people who need someplace to sleep. And it's really affecting. I mean, there was a young woman and her mom who spoke, probably 15, I would guess, 15, 16 years old, talked about how she volunteered at the soup kitchen in Brainerd. And she broke down as she was talking about this older woman that she got to have a conversation with there in her 70s or 80s. She said, you know, she lived a normal life before, but something happened and she wasn't able to afford where she lived. She ended up homeless. And it was a very cold winter night, this example she gave. And they ended up giving the woman a ride to the Bridge on 7th shelter that night, which is just down the road from the soup kitchen. And she's like, imagine if she had to walk, and she probably has walked. She's like, it was below zero, you know, and this could be your grandmother. This could be your aunt, your sister. And she really was emotional about it and asking the council to consider allowing. And what Bridges of Hope wants to do is basically pilot this. They want to give it a shot. You know, they recognize that this is beyond their original sort of promise, intention of the warming shelter for the colder months. But they do feel like now that this ordinance has been passed, it's incumbent upon them and it's incumbent upon the council to support the idea of a nonprofit solution. They're not asking for money. You know, they're not asking for anything beyond just permission.
And are they giving reasons as to why they don't want to give permission?
Yeah, so there's been a few reasons thrown out there. One of the reasons that some of the council members were concerned about was that the shelter is attracting people from outside the city. And so, you know, they pointed to a couple different statistics or anecdotes that they feel support that idea. The fact that, for instance, there's something called the point in time count. It's a count that's done every January, and it's meant to essentially survey the number of homeless people living across the United States. It's done on the same night across the whole country, which can be problematic if you think about it. For Minnesota, January, it's going to be a little harder to find folks. And so the number of homeless people counted in Crow Wing County has risen dramatically in the last couple of years. And, you know, on the one hand, it's like that could potentially be representative of homelessness being a worse problem here. It could be a representation of people coming to Crow Wing County because there's a shelter here. Or it could be a representation of the fact that because the warming shelter exists and because there is a stronger safety net that exists in our community now to get the word out, to get people counted, to make sure that they're getting counted as homeless, because there's funding attached to that. There's things related to that that help regions if they're having an issue. And, you know, previously people were sleeping on someone's couch and maybe didn't want to come forward and say they were homeless. So that's one of the reasons. Another reason that was pointed to was police activity in the neighborhood. So the police chief presented a list of all of the police calls to the Bridge on 7th shelter or within a block of the shelter. And it was presented as, look at this increase in police calls to this area. But if you look a little bit deeper, 35 of those calls that were listed of the, I believe it was 119, were emergency medical services calls. So theoretically, they would be responding to those no matter where they were in the city. Some of them were calls to help people who are suicidal. Some of them were called, a lot of them were calls simply to be helped to get to or into the shelter. Some of them were from the shelter staff of like checking to make sure that welfare checks on people. Hey, we haven't seen this person for a while. You know, have you seen them? Are they in jail? Is there a concern that we should have that they haven't shown up? So it's complicated, right? I mean, of course, the building was vacant before. So yeah, there were not as many police calls to that building before it became a shelter.
How many people can they house there?
There are is a capacity of 30. There is, I want to say something like 24-ish beds in that, or maybe a couple fewer, and then space for people on the floor as well if they reach that point. That was another thing, too, is that Bridge on 7th was hoping to expand their capacity a little bit to accommodate some of the, you know, there's nights where they have hit that capacity. And, yeah, they also, another whole part of it was just that they want 3 years of stable permitting so that they can pursue grant funding and have a steady lease. And the council decided to reduce their permit to a year, which was another wrinkle in this whole thing that has fired some people up in the community, like wanting to support the shelter.
And what did you say? What was the vote on that from the city council?
So as far as like what they decided?
Yeah. What was it, a close?
Well, so ultimately it was passed unanimously. But in, you know, my estimation was that some of the council members who maybe would have supported the idea of the year-round shelter or the longer permit length just wanted to support the fact that, yes, we're going to renew it for another year, which was essentially what the vote was. So they didn't necessarily vote, quote unquote, vote down. There wasn't a vote that said like, no, you cannot open this summer. It was more just that they didn't take it up.
Okay.
They didn't say like, you know, yes, affirmatively, we're okay with you trying this out.
Chelsea's telling us about the Brainerd area. I know homelessness is happening throughout our entire region. We've done stories coming out of Bemidji or Grand Rapids as well, and how small towns are trying to deal with this. I think along with food insecurity, I think if you start thinking about it, everybody's just a couple of steps away from this, because there's a lot of barriers to finding a place to live that we don't maybe think about, because we know we can, if we can't afford it, maybe our family can help us with the deposit or that kind of thing.
Absolutely. And, you know, in a tight housing market, if you have an eviction on your record, good luck. Good luck getting someone to rent to you. And, you know, not that I'm saying that, like, obviously getting an eviction, that's a difficult position that you likely contributed to getting yourself into.